if one looks at the probability of these six inscribed ossuaries in unison, when you multiply them all together, I would say that that would be an absolute slam dunk and very, very remarkable.
That's an excerpt from last night's Discovery Channel documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the third hour of the program, we're going to be talking about last night's documentary. I'm Todd Wilkin. Did you see it? And did you watch the subsequent conversation debate that followed afterwards? I want to hear from you in this hour. Our call-in number 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, your comments, your thoughts on the Lost Tomb of Jesus documentary, Issues ETC at KFUO.org. Well, at least that guy said it was a slam dunk. If you add up the names and the coincidence of the names in the tomb, and then you say, how likely would it be that they all be in one tomb together? It's a slam dunk, and that remarkable. That's what you probably heard last night. Is it true? We'll answer those questions here in this hour of Issues Etc. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is a regular guest. He's assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, author of an article titled The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. Pastor Kloa, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Good to be back. I'm curious, when you use that term perfect storm, what are you talking about?
Well, what I mean is, if you recall the movie a couple years ago, the fishing boat and this combination of factors that led to this unbelievable storm, that's basically what we're asked to believe has taken place in this tomb find here, that a number of highly improbable events have come together at just the right place to give us this amazing find that Jesus is, in fact, his bones are lying in the tomb. And that's what we're asked to believe, that this long chain of events all have taken place in just exactly this precise way to lead to the, as you say, slam dunk conclusion that Jesus is still in there.
So it's a big series of big ifs, one after another, that one needs to buy into before you can actually arrive at the conclusions that seem to be presupposed.
Exactly.
In last night's documentary.
Exactly. And in fact, the way they presented the show itself was a series. You kind of had to buy the first point about Jesus, and then the second point about Mary, and then the third about Mati, and then Jose, and then Maramne, and it just on and on and on. And they built it, you know, step by step. And if you took any one piece out, the whole thing, of course, would fall down. But the way it was presented was in the smooth, everything has been proven, and now we can reach the conclusion at the end that Jesus is still there.
What was your initial thought after watching the documentary last night on the Discovery Channel?
To be honest, probably after about 15 or 20 minutes, I really felt that I had wasted my time writing this article last week, because I was honestly expecting it to be a little bit more provocative, a little bit more evidence, a little bit more persuasive, and it was, to me, pretty obvious that the evidence was being sort of half-truthed. The alternative arguments were not being presented. I thought they would at least offer alternative explanations, but these were not forthcoming. We were simply asked to believe everything they said without being given all the evidence.
What was your reaction to the roundtable debate slash discussion led by Ted Koppel after the premiere of this documentary?
Yeah, that was interesting. I did not realize that was going to be on. I was pleased, I guess I'd say. I don't know that many people would have. Well, in fact, I do know. I looked at some websites today criticizing Ted Koppel for being what they called very one-sided. I appreciated his holding the filmmakers to their evidence. So you say this person said this. Well, I contacted this person, and here's what he said he says. And I think that's good journalism. I appreciated the, if you will, exposure of the sort of half-truth argumentation that we got throughout the show.
I'm wondering about the, you mentioned this before, about the, if you accept points 1 through 10,
right,
then the inescapable conclusion,
right,
is that Jesus died, stayed dead, and here is at least the box that once held his bones.
Right.
It strikes me that any argument made, regardless of what the conclusion is supposed to be, any argument made that requires you to believe a whole series of unlikely things to come to an inevitable conclusion is flawed from its very beginning. All sorts of conspiracy theories are constructed in this way.
Well, conspiracy theory is a good way to describe it, actually. Yes, that you have this sort of, you might call it a Jenga game, you know, this huge tower of pieces, and any one piece would come out and it would fall down. One of my concerns in the whole thing was they used, or they portrayed anyway, the use of scientific evidence. So they do a DNA test, and they'll do a patina test. And it's sort of a little bit of a slice of science here and a little bit of a slice of science there. But the overall methodology, the overall argument was far from scientific. It was simply building on assumption after assumption after assumption, unproven statement, unproven statement. And so it gave sort of the facade of a scientific method without actually being scientific. It was, I think, deceptive.
So in other words, they took pains to prove that the inscriptions were old.
Right.
But that is really irrelevant to their argument.
Yeah, nobody debates that they're first century inscriptions. Not an issue at all.
Or they took pains to prove that the Jesus DNA, supposedly,
right,
and the Mariamne DNA, supposedly, were not patrilineally connected, which is really irrelevant to their argument.
Exactly. It's irrelevant. I mean, the Mariamne could be Jesus' mother, could be sister, sister-in-law, cousin. I mean, who knows? It could be any relationship whatsoever.
I want to hear from our listeners this hour who watched the Lost Tomb of Jesus documentary last night. Our in-studio email address issues etc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Issues, etc. is coming to you live this Monday, March the 5th. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa, assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, is our guest. He's written a very interesting article titled The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. Let's walk through some of the big ifs that must be conceded in order to come to Cameron and Jacobovici's conclusions from the documentary last night. What is the first if that they are asking all of us to believe?
Well, what they walk through first is it's each name individually. And, you know, the remarkable coincidence, of course, that Jesus, son of Joseph, is the Jesus of Nazareth described in the Gospels. Now, you know, that's of course, it could be any Jesus. They admitted that it's a very common name. Joseph is a very common name. So, you know, the really if stuff starts with Mary, where they're actually kind of starting to prove some things or build up their argument. And, I mean, immediately things sort of go wrong. One claim they make, for example, with Mary is the inscription uses the form Maria, which is the Latin form of the name. Not at all unusual, very common. The Hebrew or Aramaic form would be Miriam, and they make the claim that the Latin form is used, Maria, in the film, because she apparently attracted a large number of Roman converts to Christianity, who then used her Latin name Maria, and that's why we have this form on the ossuary rather than Miriam. Now, what you got to understand is every Mary. Every single Mary mentioned in the New Testament has the spelling Maria. It has absolutely nothing to do with supposed converts or Romans or whatever. I mean, it's just an incredible assertion. It's inept. I don't know how else to describe it.
You know, I was looking through some of these claims, and I thought to myself, anyone who has a first-year seminary student who just graduated from his initial Greek course could walk through with his concordance, find every instance of the name Mary in the New Testament,
right,
and see for himself that there's nothing remarkable about that usage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just standard. I have no idea where that claim comes from.
Okay. What about the claim that, and I think this is a big one that they make, that Jesus, first of all, laying aside the issue of whether or not he faked his own death or survived the crucifixion or something like this.
Right.
The living Jesus relocated his family to Jerusalem.
Right. Now, that is not at all mentioned in the movie or in the film. It was quite a black hole. And no mention of why the family would have moved there or how they got there. One claim was that they mentioned the phrase, later tradition places Mary at Jerusalem. Now, they didn't tell you this in the movie, but the later tradition must be an apocryphal writing called The Assumption of the Virgin or The Assumption of Mary, written in the 4th century, which has Mary dying in Jerusalem. I mean, it's the only reference we have. So now you're talking about a 4th century text which is used to place the Holy Family in Jerusalem. That's a rather big stretch. Another problem is the fact that this tomb is not a common tomb. The only people who would afford a tomb like this must be extremely wealthy. I'm sure your other guests must have talked about this. So you have to have a basically, even if you want to call Joseph middle class, which would be a stretch, you have to have this family moving to Jerusalem after the death of Jesus, when we have, you know, the book of Acts and other writings, even Josephus, describing Christians being persecuted in Jerusalem. Somehow this family has acquired great amounts of wealth, enough to purchase an elaborate tomb, which would be very uncommon, and have two or three generations placed in this tomb. There is no historical basis in this. There's no plausible history you can reconstruct that would place a family of Jesus, followers of Jesus, even in this situation before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70.
In fact, the general impression that we get from the New Testament is that the epicenter of Christianity really splits into two very early,
right,
with the Jewish persecution.
Exactly.
So that some Christians, of course, do remain in Jerusalem, but many of them, or at least the Christian center, becomes far north in Antioch.
In Antioch, exactly. Well, you do have, of course, James placed in Jerusalem, although he's, again, martyred very early. So there's little evidence that this could even happen, that this family could acquire wealth. You know, they describe typical burial practices. Well, those are typical burial practices for very wealthy people. The average person would have been buried in a way very similar to Western practice of just a pit, a shallow grave, and covered with dirt. This would be strikingly unusual.
I want to talk about the burial practices. We talked with Dr. Craig Evans last night on the nationally syndicated edition of our program, and he had written a book called Jesus and the Ossuaries, and he pointed out that this whole ossuary practice among first century Palestinian Jews is first of all a very convenient way of dating the burials, because it dates from about 20 B.C., to about 60,
right,
the Herodian period, where Herod's stonemasons are basically building Jerusalem and the temple.
Mm-hmm.
But he also pointed out that it was by far not the common practice for Jews.
Exactly. Very uncommon. Again, you have to come up with a way for Jesus' family to acquire the wealth and the stature to be able to purchase this, to be buried in this way. There's no indication that they ever lived in this way.
Did the documentary make any attempt to explain why, without exception, the sepulcher site in Christian tradition from the time of Constantine has been what is now known as the Church of the Holy Sepulcher?
Right. No, that was not discussed at all. There was no argument against any other perspective. We were simply given one way of viewing the evidence, and alternative explanations or past arguments were not presented at all. So again, we were given only one stream, which is all basically new.
Let's talk about, an ossuary is one thing with a name on it. Let's talk about the evidence that was presented in the documentary that Jesus' bones were actually in the ossuary that supposedly bears the name Yeshua.
Right.
What was the evidence that they presented there?
Well, the evidence was, you know, you have the inscription, of course, but the evidence was, and this was a little bit shady or hard for me to understand. They claim to have scraped some remains of Jesus, unstated, some kind of material, bone fragment, something that were left in this ossuary. Also from the ossuary of the Mariamne, and they said that the other ossuaries were, James Tabor said, they were vacuumed, so there was no evidence available. Now, all that gives you is some DNA. What do you compare it to? I mean, there's no way that the DNA does you any good unless you have a parent to check it against. So the DNA in itself can't identify anyone. It can only clarify relationships if there is a blood relationship with someone else, and we don't have anyone else. So.
Well, part of their argument is that there is no blood relationship between the DNA taken from the Jesus ossuary and the DNA taken from the Mariamne, supposedly Mary Magdalene's ossuary.
Right.
Therefore, they must have been husband and wife.
Yeah. Again,
what do you make of that conclusion?
Well, that's just they could be any kind of relationship. They could be, as I said before, a cousin. It could be Mariamne. They could be somebody else's wife from the tomb. She could be a half-sister. I mean, the only conclusion you reach is that they are not brother and sister. That's the only conclusion you can reach based on the DNA evidence. And this was made pretty clear, I think, in the interview after the show. In fact, apparently, Ted Koppel, his team, whoever, contacted the person that did the DNA testing, and he claimed that he was misrepresented, quoted out of context, that you can't, as you said before, make the claim that they were married based on DNA. It's simply impossible.
Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is our guest. He's assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, author of an article, The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. This is Issues Etc. coming to you live this Monday, March the 5th. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're doing kind of a post-Lost Tomb of Jesus documentary, and I'd like to hear from our listeners who saw last night's Discovery Channel documentary, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Your general impressions, questions it raised, or what you may have seen as glaring elements of leaps of logic. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. This comes from Bob in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. He writes, I was struck by the fact that on the Discovery Channel special, only two of the ossuaries were genetically tested, and that was used as proof that Mary was married to Mary Magdalene. I was wondering why they didn't test the other ossuaries. For instance, why not test to see if Jesus and Mary, i.e. Maria, were related? That relationship would be much more interesting. And also, if Jesus and Mary Magdalene were not related, perhaps she was married to someone else in the tomb. First of all, let's deal with that whole issue of, as far as you could tell, was there any attempt to do DNA testing in the other ossuaries to determine, say, mother and son relationship between the other Maria?
Right. There was not any testing done. That was a question I raised also right away with this. And it would seem to be obvious that if you could get any DNA evidence, that would be significant. Keep in mind, we don't know if the Maria in the name Maria has any relationship to the Yeshua in the tomb. We have no way of knowing. The assumption is she's the mother of the Yeshua, but we do that because, or they did that, because of the biblical names. They're taking the biblical data and then fitting the ossuaries to match. They claim, again, that they tried to, but there was not enough available. They didn't go to extreme measures, they claim, to try to get DNA. I would think that this would be a rather important piece of data if you're going to try to establish any kind of genetic relationship between these people, and every effort should have been made. If I could read you a quote that from an article, this was in the New York Times last February 27th already. The filmmaker Simka Jakubovici here says, quote, we're not scientists on this point. We're not scientists. At the end of the day, we can't wait until every ossuary is tested for DNA, he said. We took the story that far. At some point, you have to say, I've done my job as a journalist, end quote. Now, I think that's rather revealing. He's convinced himself, essentially. He sees himself as a journalist, not as a scientist. He doesn't see the need to go to the full kind of present all the data, okay? He isn't going to check every ossuary. He isn't going to check every inscription. He's going to do enough to convince himself and then throw it out there. So it points up again that we do not have a full scientific study of this. We have one group's kind of haphazard, trust me on this sort of approach.
Well, the general rule, of course, is in any endeavor where evidence is presented, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proofs.
Exactly.
Were there any extraordinary proofs that you came to in watching the documentary?
There were absolutely no surprises except for the claims, which are simply absurd. I mean, I started making a list, obviously, of things that were just unbelievable, whoppers. And I mean, we can go through those if you like. But
I'd like very much to go through those.
You know, they kind of come up in connection with each name, but. No, there was nothing that surprised me or threw me for a loop or was unexpected, except in its rather almost absurdity, if you will.
Ruth calls from her car. Let's see what Ruth has to say. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I can read Greek and Hebrew, and I looked at the writings on the ossuaries, and particularly the Jesus ossuary is so difficult to read, looks like chicken scratching. And I know Professor Kuala has experience with looking at these ancient biblical texts. Are some of them generally that messy?
All right, very good question, Ruth. Thank you for the call.
Right. I think that was a fair description. Frank Moore Cross was brought in as an expert, and you know, you're going to the top of the class with that. So they went to the right person. And no, there's nothing unusual in the format. Some are more professionally inscribed, you might say. Some are simply individuals, perhaps from the family, who scratched a name in. And so you would expect a rough, very difficult to read inscription. I don't really think there's any question about the names themselves on the ossuaries, or that those are original. I looked at the original archaeological report on this, and they came to the exact same conclusions as far as what the names, the letters on the tomb say. Now, they came to different conclusions about who those names might represent, completely different conclusions. Mm-hmm. But as far as the inscriptions themselves, there really is nothing unusual about the format, the roughness, the difficulty of reading. That's fairly standard.
But it strikes me that if you were intent, like the documentary makers appear to be, upon kind of snowing the public with look over here and look over there and a series of distractions leading to what they say is an inevitable conclusion, the fact that the inscriptions may be more or less clear might generally work in their favor. Then they're left to do what they're doing through most of this, which is speculate, right?
Well, yeah. See, they're taking we know exactly what the names are in the inscriptions. There's no doubt about that. It's what they do with the names that's the problem.
This email comes from Carol in St. Louis. She says, I thought that these boxes were often used to hold the bones for a number of people. How do they know that the DNA came from the person named Jesus in that particular box or Mary in the other box?
Yeah, that has taken place in a few cases. I think the advantage or the argument against that in this case is that the tomb appears to be one family, several generations, and not sort of reused or recycled sort of a thing. Basically an untouched burial until, I shouldn't say that. The original archaeological report indicated that a couple of the covers were off the ossuaries and in the middle of the burial chamber. So there might have been some robbery or something in antiquity. But there's no indication of sort of reuse in these cases. It seems to be fairly straightforward.
More of your phone calls and your email after the break on last night's Lost Tomb of Jesus documentary. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is our guest. We're getting his reaction to it. I'm very anxious to hear yours as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, as others have already, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Kloa has authored an article titled The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. So far in our conversation, not the perfect storm it purports to be. When we come back from this break, amidst your calls and email, we will walk through the list of whoppers, as he says, that struck him most as he watched the Discovery Channel's documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus. You know, I got home last night very late, and they were replaying this thing. And I must admit, I'll admit it to you folks, I was tired. I'd been working late into the evening on a Sunday night, and there was no amount of scotch that was going to get me to watch the entire thing. There were better things on. I think it was some rerun of a very old movie on HBO. I think that's what I ended up watching last night. I want to hear from you, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
They crucified the Son of Man. His death was part of Jesus' plan. I can't explain the mystery. He did what he did for me. These are words from the Issues, Etc. book of the month for March, titled Easter is for Me. It's a picture book for children ages 4 through 7. Easter is for Me is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org. Easter is for Me cost $14.99 plus shipping and handling, and it's written by popular children's author Dandy Daly McCall. Easter is for Me encourages children to see that Jesus lived, died, and conquered sin, death, and the devil for them. Easter is for Me, a possible gift for your young child, grandchild, or godchild this Easter. Easter is for me, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. 1-800-325-3040.
A culture war. Now, what is it?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution. Well, Ken, we hear about it all over the TV news and we read it in the newspapers, but how would you define what is meant by the culture wars of today?
Well, Mark, ever since the creation of the world, we know there's been a battle between good and evil. And really, the culture war is just the same battle. But it's manifesting itself in particular ways in this era of history. You know, America was founded as a Christian nation. But today, we find Christians becoming more and more marginalized in this country. The Christian worldview has come under massive attack. We see nativity scenes being removed from public places. Creation, Bible, and prayer have all but been thrown out of public schools. The Ten Commandments have been removed from public places. Abortion has been legalized. And now there's even a battle to legalize gay marriage across the country. But the root of this battle is really God's word versus human reason. And sadly, one of the ways human reason has taken over the thinking of so many is because of the teaching of evolution and millions of years. They permeated the culture and caused many to reject the Bible as a credible book. You see, upholding God's word in Genesis, that's at the front lines of fighting this culture war.
Ken Ham has written a fascinating booklet on today's culture wars. Discover how some of the hot-button issues of the day relate to the question over the accuracy of the book of Genesis. The booklet's free at AnswersRadio.com.
What kind of international relief projects can you and your congregation help support? Here's Pastor John Folley of LCMS World Relief.
We've got some significant projects that continue to go on internationally. In Indonesia and in Kenya. Specifically in Kenya, as we've been sending out these Mercy medical teams, providing opportunities for congregations and individuals to adopt orphans and to build orphanages and clinics, to provide clean water. A lot of things that we're doing internationally with our partner churches, with World Mission, connecting our works of mercy with proclamation of the gospel.
LCMS World Relief, 1-888-930-4438.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
There's an X here before the name, and then the name Yeshua, then the Father's name, Yehoshaphat.
What happens? The bodies I leave up to God.
Well, this is a little bit from the documentary last night on the Discovery Channel, The Lost Tomb of Jesus. We're talking about it with Pastor Jeffrey Kloa during this last half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, and we're coming to you live this Monday, the 5th of March. Our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, and author of an article titled The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. You can read it under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Right there at the homepage, click What's New, and you'll find the article right there for you to read. Here's an email from Susan in Tupelo, Mississippi. She writes, I'm not convinced that the purveyors of this program even believe their own claims. They present quote-unquote evidence that hasn't even created doubt, let alone convinced archaeologists, secular or religious. It's just a convenient opportunity to muddy Christianity for the unbeliever. Surely they know that true believers, whether in Christ or in science, are not giving them a second glance. Your thoughts there, Pastor Kloa?
Well, it's awfully hard to assess what people believe. I mean, I would say the Jacobovici seemed pretty convinced himself, especially in the interview afterward. At least he thought he was onto something. And you might also, if you're really interested in this, I did look today at the Discovery Channel website where they have blogs people can contribute or discussion pages, and most people responding there were positive toward the show and negative toward the interview after with Ted Koppel. So, I think it did convince some people, unfortunately, probably people who already thought Christianity was a sham and was a cover-up in the first place.
So, in your opinion, will you and I talked before we came on the air about how easily both of us have tired of this subject. Yeah. I tired of it last week, even before the actual documentary had, simply because it hardly merits a response. Right. But do you think you'll be answering questions about this for quite some time, given the fact that some are convinced?
I really don't think so. I saw some media reports today characterizing the show as the Geraldo opening Capone's tomb. I don't know if you remember that back in Chicago, and it was empty. I really think this will sort of go away. Unfortunately, it will go away and not be sort of the details not be remembered. But I'm sure the impression will linger that, well, gee, maybe they did find the bones, and maybe it was fake, maybe it wasn't, and nobody will really look at the arguments. Nobody will really follow through on this. Much like there's almost, it seems, a virtual assumption that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had something going on, you know. There's no evidence for this whatsoever, but it's you know, since the Da Vinci Code, it's sort of in the air, and people who don't take the time to investigate these things simply just, oh, yeah, okay, you know, and it's... So the effects of it will probably linger. Whether it will really have any major impact swaying people one way or the other, I doubt. But and I don't think we'll be talking about this specific archaeological find very much at all.
You said that in the course of watching the documentary, you were making a list of what you called whoppers, things that really struck you as audacious, right. And you wanted to begin with the name Joseph.
Right.
What was there?
Well, the Joseph incident or description was that now the inscription says just Jose or Josie, how they said it, which is an abbreviation for Joseph, standard abbreviation. Now, you got to understand the original archaeological report simply assumed, and I think rightly, that you had three generations in the tomb. Jesus, son of Joseph, a Joseph, presumably the father of this Jesus, and then a Judas, son of Jesus, presumably the Jesus in the tomb, which would indicate three generations. Very likely, very plausible reconstruction. There's no evidence to contradict that. That would be the natural way you would understand this group of ossuaries. What the movie does is not make Joseph the father. They argue that Jose is some sort of a corruption of the form Joses, which is one of the names of Jesus' brothers given in Mark 6:3.
J-O-S-E-S.
Okay. In English, I suppose you'd spell it that way. Mm-hmm. And, Joses, without the P-H at the end, with an S. And now, where they come up with this, they don't have any parallel inscriptions that this would be an abbreviation for. They simply, I think, realize that they cannot get Joseph to Jerusalem. So they have to somehow have a Jesus family tomb without Joseph, and so they make this Jose into Joses instead of Joseph, and they leave Joseph somewhere up in Galilee. Now, that's not what the archaeologists did, and I was actually, when I wrote the little article there, that's what I was assuming they were going to do, because I don't know what else you could do with it. I was really rather floored that that's the direction they went. I don't know how you can get there. We can talk a little about Mati. That sort of messes everything up because they're trying to match the names of Jesus' family in the Bible with the inscriptions, and there's no Mati, so they got to go over to Luke to find something in his family line, and it must have been a family name, but we didn't know about it. That, you know, again, there's no evidence.
That also raises something that we've noted several times in our conversation on this documentary of a general nature, which is the documentary makers seem to want to go to the New Testament when it suited their arguments,
or exactly.
When they could make it suit their arguments, ignore the New Testament
when it didn't,
and right. Then if they could find some sort of apocryphal writing that may or may not,
right.
Much later writing, support their argument, they were willing to go to that, too.
Right. I mean, that's the case with Mary and the, you know, as mentioned, the assumption of Mary text, which has her dying in Jerusalem. You know, there's no reference in the New Testament to this at all. No other references. We have no idea what happens to Mary. The whoppers, the biggest whoppers, come with Mary Magdalene, and we could spend the next half hour talking about Mary Magdalene in this.
What are those? What should we know basically about the claims that were made in the documentary and how audacious they may be about Mary Magdalene?
I mean, the first thing is that Mariamne, which is the inscription on the tomb, is a reference only to Mary Magdalene, that this is a name that would have been uniquely attributed to Mary Magdalene. Now, the evidence they claim for this is an apocryphal writing called the Acts of Philip, which is a 4th-century text, has been known for some time, although some incomplete form. A recent manuscript find, I think it's a 12th-century manuscript, has given us the rest of the text. But the relevant section that they're talking about, and I actually brought it along here if I could flip it open for a second. There's a reference to a Mariamne here, but let me read this. Okay. Philip is sent by Jesus to go,
You're reading from an apocryphal 4th
right.
century
this is a 4th
writing.
Century okay. text, and this is where they're getting the connection between Mariamne and Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
Apparently. Now, Philip is going to go evangelize among the Greeks, and then it says this. Mariamne, his sister, that is Philip, and then this description, it was she who made ready the bread and salt at the breaking of the bread, but Martha was the one who ministered to the multitudes and labored much. Now, that seems to me to refer to the Mary and Martha from the gospel story.
Sisters of Lazarus.
Sisters of Lazarus, exactly. Now, it continues and says, Philip says to her, I know you chosen among women, plural. So it's not even that the Mariamne is elevated somehow to a higher position like they want Mary Magdalene to be. It's the Mariamne and the Martha that are elevated. Furthermore, the same text describes Mariamne ending up in Jordan and dying in Jordan rather than in Jerusalem. So why you get the name Mariamne referring to Mary Magdalene, that's decisive proof, but then she ends up in Jordan and you don't accept that. It's sort of cherry-picking little bits and pieces.
I think Craig Evans called it last night. He said this is what we call special pleading.
Special pleading, yeah.
Picking and choosing whatever evidence from whatever source supports your argument.
Yeah, without countering anything else, exactly. Yeah, just take it on faith. The other thing with this inscription that's really astonishing is the argument that the Mara, as they describe it at the end of the inscription, Mariamne e Mara, is actually an Aramaic title for master. Now, how you get a Greek name with an Aramaic title is a little bit touchy or questionable. Why Mary Magdalene would be called master is another issue. A far more simple explanation, again, is given by the original archaeologists who found parallel inscriptions that have the exact same form. One of them is Alexa a Mara, which they translate Alexa, who is also called Mara. So it's just an alternative name, a nickname if you want. It's usually understood as an abbreviation for Martha. And it's far simpler to see this in parallel with those inscriptions that see this as another name rather than as some kind of exalted title of Mary Magdalene, which, again, I think they're just getting sort of Da Vinci Code. I mean, where else would you get this from?
So I'm trying to picture... could it simply be that the documentary makers here came across something that they overestimated in importance, may have done the research, but were not the good researchers,
mm-hmm.
Cherry-picked the evidence, as you said, and hastily drew a conclusion about this, after made their film, and after which are having to stand by a position that is completely untenable?
Yeah, I think the procedure they used is one which will get you into trouble every time, where you have the answers before you start. So you have a Jesus, son of Joseph, ossuary, and immediately you think Jesus of Nazareth in the Bible. You got a couple other names, and you simply run with it and look for ways to make the data fit rather than looking for plausible, historically verifiable solutions, and then letting the answers fall where they may. It's working from the answer to the question rather than the other way around.
So what did you think of last night's Discovery Channel documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus? Give us a call, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727, or send us your email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is our guest. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Much is made of the statistical, or the so-called statistical analysis of name frequencies in first century Palestine. What can you tell us about this?
Well, all I can tell you is the evidence that we have. Mary, for example, is used apparently as 25% of known names of women in the first century are Mary. Jesus is approximately about 9%. This is all in standard scholarly reference works. I'm not a statistician. When they're throwing up numbers about 27 million or 97 million this and reduce it by 400 and 600, I honestly don't understand statistics. It seems again to be this sort of we're going to use science for this one little slice, but the overall approach is not going to be scientific. I will also say that the interview with Ted Koppel again afterward, who contacted the statistician, who also backpedaled a bit from his conclusions and said, well, this is all I was given, and had I had more evidence, I would not have reached these conclusions. So again, it was sort of only giving partial evidence to the experts even.
One of the things that Evans pointed out last night in the program was, look, if you understand how many of these ossuaries are potentially out there undiscovered during this roughly 100-year period in which ossuaries was a standard for upper-scale burials. And how what a fraction of them have been discovered. It's any statistics based upon merely the discovered ossuaries are not going to be accurate as to how frequent you're going to find a box with the name Jesus, son of Joseph.
Right. I mean, we have, what, about 2,000 ossuaries, I think, is the inscriptions from ossuaries, I think, is the number. That's not a very large statistical sample to talk about a population of Jerusalem in the first century.
You use an analogy with the Fab Four. John Paul and Ringo, John Paul and Ringo. Now, the first three names are very common.
Right.
Play that out for us. I think it would be very helpful for our listeners if they're approached at the water cooler to respond to this whole frequency of names argument.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. The argument was this Evans' argument? I saw that somewhere else, too.
I don't think so.
Oh, really?
It might have been Ben Witherington.
Witherington, I saw it somewhere. Yeah. Actually, I think Cameron used it himself, where he argued, well, if you say, George, Paul, John, so what? There's all kinds of names. But the Ringo is the one that clinches it. It can only be the Beatles, if you find some kind of reference. And what Cameron claimed was that the Mariamne was the Ringo, okay? So almost the entire argument stands or falls on Mariamne being Mary Magdalene.
But and there is no word Magdalene or Magdala or any of that on any of these ossuaries.
No reference at all.
That would be the Ringo, wouldn't it?
That would be the Ringo, exactly. But no Magdala, none of that sort anywhere on the ossuary, exactly.
I guess I'm wondering, even if you were to find the Jesus, son of Joseph, a Mary, a Josie, a Matti, and a Mariam Magdala, something along those lines, all you'd really have is evidence that perhaps the Mary Magdalene is buried along with other people with those names.
Well, exactly. You'd still have to account for how Jesus and his family would have acquired this wealth, how they ended up in Jerusalem. I mean, that's always the sort of, to me, huge issue, which is never confronted in all this. And you have to get the family down to Jerusalem and get them a lot of money. They have to win the lotto or something,
Did they ever in the documentary deal with the fact that in the New Testament accounts of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection, there is already a theory placed out on the table by the opponents of Jesus after his death and his resurrection? They anticipate an empty tomb, and they understand an empty tomb, saying his disciples stole his body.
Right. In fact, they use that as the basis for their argument. In fact, they started off with that it's reported in Matthew that the priests paid the soldiers to say that the disciples came and stole the body. Now, what's interesting, though, is they do not use it in the same way that Matthew portrays the religious leaders using it. See, the religious leaders want to deny the resurrection, okay? The filmmakers use that to say that Jesus couldn't have stayed in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. He was taken out of that tomb and placed into this tomb in Talpiot. So they're claiming anyway to not deny the resurrection or the possibility of the resurrection. They're using that only to have the disciples take Jesus and put him in the family tomb, which they must have already owned in Jerusalem somehow.
So again, this is an example of taking one bit of information out of the gospel texts, completely out of context,
right,
and turning it toward the purpose of their argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think the worst one in all this, and this is just, you know, your jaw drops at this. They claim that the beloved disciple in the Gospel of John, who is unidentified by name, there's several theories. Maybe it's John the author. Maybe it's Lazarus. There's no clear indication. It seems to be the author of the Gospel, whoever it is. So there's several theories. But they claim that the beloved disciple who is reclining at Jesus' bosom at the Last Supper and who's at the foot of the cross is, in fact, Judah, the child of Mary and Jesus. Now, what this means, and they actually portray this in the depiction, so you have this Judah, or Jesus speaking to Judah and Mary Magdalene at the cross and saying, you know, mother, behold your son, behold your mother. Well, they conveniently forget that in John, where they're drawing this from, it actually has his mother. It says his mother is the one standing at the foot of the cross. It doesn't say generic woman. You know, Mary Magdalene is there along with another Mary. And Mary, his mother, but they completely ignore, it says his mother. He says to his mother, you know, woman, behold your son. So again, I mean, where are they reading the same text? Or do they think we're not going to look this up? I mean, it's sort of, how do you say that?
Well, they seem to be operating on a presupposition that the New Testament text is so riddled with uncertainty and unreliability that you can draw any conclusion from it you want because, of course, it's probably not accurate in the first place.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose that's the approach. We'll find historically true references where we wish. I mean, again, if I could refer to this Acts of Philip, which they claim gives us the name Mary, the same Acts of Philip claims that a leopard walked up and started speaking to Philip, and that Philip slew this large serpent in a city and then condemned the Jews and swallowed them up in a huge pit. Kind of, I mean, it's a fantastic, you know, a fantasy sort of a writing. Yet it has this one tiny shred which is true and must trump everything else. I mean, it's
if you approach the New Testament, I'm trying to stand in their shoes for a second without lending any credence to their arguments. If you approach the New Testament on equal footing with pseudepigraphal, apocryphal writings like the Acts of Philip.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's all an even playing field. Yeah, you can pick enough and choose as you want,
yeah,
right?
Well, you have to have some controls. I mean, you have to have some methodology which will allow you to say this we can rely on and this we cannot. And this text is presented as factual information. This text is not. You have to have some sort of a methodology that allows you to sift and. In my book, anyway, you can't simply pick that which is going to fit your argument just because. That's not scientifically, that's not scholarly.
Have the documentary makers in this case, in essence, done sound biblical scholarship and those tempted toward less than sound biblical scholarship a big favor by saying, this is what it looks like when you hack around on this stuff?
Well, it's sort of embarrassing, actually. I mean, if this is what biblical scholarship is, shame on all of us. I do find it interesting that the vast majority of biblical scholars have stayed away from this or criticized it. Even people who are not friendly to Orthodox Christianity have really stayed away from this topic, and I find that very telling. That people do not wish to be associated with this line of argumentation, this approach to this material.
Have you had to answer any questions from your prospective pastoral students on the documentary today?
Well, today was the first day of the quarter. They were just worried about how many papers they'd have to write. So we mentioned it a little bit, but we'll talk about it a little bit further when we get to this. I'm teaching Synoptic Gospels.
What was the general tenor of the conversation?
Most sort of realized that this is just absurd. There really wasn't. And several had already read several pieces on this, so they were prepared to sift through it. Yeah, there really wasn't much concern. I will say my colleague Dave Lewis last week, I think it was on Tuesday already, told me that one of the parents at his school where his children attend walked up to him and said, so, you going to close the seminary? and he used it as an opportunity. Well, you know, let's talk about this. What are the issues exactly? And, you know, let's talk about the resurrection. So I think that's the direction to go with this. People have questions. People are interested. It's certainly something that grabs attention. But it does so in a way that I think almost works in our favor in some sense. I mean, I will say this, too. One aspect of this that is helpful is even the poor way this stuff is depicted, I think, shows just how reliable or how, I should say, congruent our New Testament is with the ancient world. I mean, it describes a tomb of Jesus, and here we have a tomb or a tomb that Jesus is placed into, and it looks pretty much like this. You know, it describes names that occur all over the New Testament, very common names. They're not just making stuff up in the New Testament. In some ways, it actually shows that the world in which the New Testament is set and described is exactly what it should be. And if there's any redeeming value, it might simply be that.
1-800-737-0172 is the phone number for our resource line. You can use that number to request a free complimentary copy of our Next Issues, Etc. journal. You can also use that number to help us defend the faith and teach the truth by making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. And as a way of saying thanks for any size gift, we'll send you a two-hour CD on the Passion and Resurrection of Jesus Christ. Or you can also donate by check. Write us at Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. No gift is too small. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa is a regular guest. He's Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, author of an article titled The Lost Tomb of Jesus, A Perfect Storm. Find it under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. When you get home tonight, issuesetc.org, click What's New, and you'll find this article by Pastor Jeffrey Kloa. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on the program, guess what? Rick Warren is coming to town. I don't know if he's been to St. Louis in a long time, but he's coming to town for an annual prayer breakfast for Greater St. Louis. And on that occasion, we'll be talking with Chris Roseborough of ExtremeTheology.com about the writings and the teachings of Pastor Warren tomorrow on the program. Let's see. He's got the purpose-driven life, the purpose-driven church, 40 Days of Purpose. That's a big part of it. He's got his global peace plan. And he has a follow-up to the whole purpose-driven movement. He has kept Zondervan in the black for about the last 5 years. We'll see what, if anything, in what way can you summarize the writings, the effect, the general theology of the man that some are calling the next Billy Graham, certainly one of the more influential evangelical teachers in the American church today. That's all tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.